Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a serial founder that is joining us. You know, he's done it multiple times. I think we're going to be learning quite a bit. You know, what he's doing now is remarkable. And again, you know, we're going to be talking about building, scaling, financing, taking companies public. I mean, all of the good stuff that we like to hear, but it's super inspiring, you know, the journey and also the story of our founder today. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest, Dr. Dave Albert. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alejandro. It's my pleasure to be here.
So originally born in Washington, D.C., give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Well, it was very interesting. My father was the Speaker of the House, so he was actually very famous and was the Speaker of the House during Watergate and twice was first in line for the presidency. So I grew up in a very interesting household, let me put it that way.
And also, you know, like you changed quite a bit, you know, the places where you were growing up, I'm sure, like making new friends, going to Oklahoma and places like that. I'm wondering, like, how did that shape you too as a person, like dealing with building new friendships, new locations, dealing with uncertainty too, being with uncertainty, which I think is a really big deal as an entrepreneur. So how do you think that shaped you up?
Well, I had an interesting contrast. Oklahoma, where we're from, is very rural. So I grew up hunting and fishing. I had a large extended family there. And of course, Washington, D.C. is the opposite of very rural. And so I had, you know, friends in school and friends back home in Oklahoma, and really lived two lives, a life of being an outdoorsman and a life of being, you know, in a major in the capital city. So it was, I think it helped broaden my experiences.
Now, in your case, you know, one thing that I felt, you know, was quite interesting is that you decided, you know, to go at it with studying in Cambridge, medicine, and then also engineering, you know, out of all things. So why did you thought, you know, it was the way to go to blend those two together?
I always wanted to be a doctor. And so I went undergrad to Harvard. And then when I graduated from Harvard, I went to Duke, to both medical school and engineering graduate school, because I always wanted to be a doctor. In fact, probably for 8 years, I wanted to be a cardiologist, and I accidentally became an entrepreneur. And so, you know, just by happen chance, working in a lab at Duke University Medical Center, I came across, I had an idea, and ultimately I learned how to make that idea into reality. And I sold it so that, you know, when most of my classmates and colleagues were making minimum wage as residents, actually less than minimum wage, working 100 hours a week and not making much money, I was driving a Corvette I'd bought for myself with money I'd made by licensing an invention. So I went back to Oklahoma to train, but I left because I came up, I'd already licensed two inventions that I'd made. Because I had an idea and nobody wanted to license it. And I thought it was my best idea. So I went to my wife and my dad and said, I'm going to drop out of medicine and become an entrepreneur. They thought it was crazy. But my mentors at Duke and at Oklahoma said, you know, Dave can always go back to medicine. So, you know, let him go see if this is, and I knew nothing about business, absolutely nothing. I'm not sure I know anything today about business, to be honest with you, because my passion is still medicine. And being an inventor. But, you know, that was 35 years ago, and I haven't looked back, a little more than 35. And so, you know, four companies later, I think I've had a very interesting professional career, despite the fact I didn't have to go back to my plan B of practicing medicine.
Now, in your case, you know, that first company, you know, you ended up selling. And then the latest one, you know, before actually, you know, you went on with AliveCor, which we're going to be talking, you know, quite extensively today. That one you took public, and it was in 99. You know, I think that at the peak of the of the valuation of the company was about $500 million. The company ended up being acquired by GE, which is amazing, you know, being able to get the acquisition from someone like that at that moment. I'm wondering, like, what was that journey to of taking the company public? You know, how was that like? Because, I mean, you were used to, you know, privately held companies, you know, inventions like you were doing. So this was, you know, like more, you know, like nerve-wracking of taking something public and writing, you know, that type of growth. So how was that for you?
But except for my first company, I was never the CEO. So I realized soon that I'm an inventor and a scientist, and I'm not a manager. So in that company, Data Critical, I had a CEO who was very experienced. He's been a serial CEO afterwards. And, you know, we were, our lead venture capitalist was New Enterprise Associates, NEA, on Sand Hill Road. We had our board meetings. So I've already been to Sand Hill Road many times, long before Coastal Ventures and others invested. But you know, and we were taken public by a firm called DLJ, Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette, doesn't exist anymore. Okay, many of those small investment banks, Hamburg and Quist, Alex Brown, they don't exist anymore. They were all acquired, really, in the aftermath of the dot-com bust. They were all acquired by larger banks like Chase and Bank of America. And so, you know, we went through the process, the roadshow, the vetting, and you know, had quarterly reports and you know, safe harbor statements and all those things. To quite frankly, I'm glad somebody else had the main responsibility for that. But you know, everybody's always looking, especially your investors, for some type of ultimate exit, be it an acquisition or a public offering. And so this was the evolution of that company, and then ultimately, you know, GE Healthcare thought we were a strategic fit. So they came in and acquired us, and actually acquired us. The shareholder vote was on 9/11/2001. It was an interesting day. We had a shareholder vote while the world was erupting. And so in and of itself, an interesting story I'll never forget.
No kidding. Now, I'm wondering, like, what was it like to go through the dot-com bust? Because I think that most founders today, they've been just riding, you know, a very easy market up until now, obviously, which is an interesting macro environment that we're all experiencing. But what has it been like to be able to experience different cycles when it comes to the market? And what have you learned as an entrepreneur too?
Well, I learned it there. We were a public company growing literally 15 or 20% quarter on quarter. And then the dot-com bust hit and everybody's stock cratered, because if you watch NASDAQ, we were on NASDAQ, went down. As a private company, we've seen something similar. So 2-3 years ago, you had an influx of all the SPACs. You saw many, many unicorn valuations. And today, most of those companies are at a fraction of the value they went out at. And so, you know, you've had a real dichotomy between the Alphabets, the Nvidias, and the Apples of the world versus privately held companies or the SPAC, the small cap companies. And I think we've watched it as a private company. Thank God we didn't go down the SPAC route, because it didn't matter what your business was. You were pulled in the downdraft that was the macro environment of the market. And so, you know, I think we made the right choices at the time. We have an outstanding management team that has great experience, and an outstanding investor cohort that said, you know, that's not the right thing to do. And I think today everybody would agree those SPACs were not the right thing to do. They were, if anything, a financial, you know, fad.
I hear you. Now, one thing led to the next. The company, you know, that you took public, you know, ended up getting acquired by GE. And you spent it, you know, like a few years there in GE. I mean, you were about 3 years before you saw what was happening. You decided that it was time, you know, as they say, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur, that it was time to go at it again. And one thing led to the next, and you end up finding yourself traveling to Hong Kong, which is a trip that changed everything for you. What happened there?
Well, it was actually dating back to 1995. I had an idea that you could not implement because the technology simply didn't exist, There were no smartphones. We didn't have digital wireless communications, things of that nature. But the notion that a patient could send their ECG immediately to a doctor and have immediate assessment of whether or not the patient needed to be cared for. And so I had that idea, but it wasn't, you couldn't do it. So in 2009, with the advent of the smartphone, I saw an opportunity to do that. So with a couple of partners, we built a prototype, and then I took a trip to Hong Kong in 2010 to go to one of the manufacturers, the many manufacturers they have in Hong Kong and Shenzhen, to manufacture some prototypes of this new device, smartphone EKG device. And on my birthday, December 14th, I received a package from Hong Kong of 15 cases for a smartphone that were EKG cases, the first Cardias. And I was planning on going to the Consumer Electronics Show in early January in Las Vegas to show a bunch of companies something I thought was a very exciting new product. And it just happened to be that four companies I wanted to talk to weren't going to be at CES. So I thought I need to show them something. So my nine-year-old taught me how to make a YouTube video. That's my youngest of four, because he made videos for Nerf gun modifications. And I went into my office and made a four-minute unscripted video. And I was uploading it to YouTube. And there happened to be a box to say, upload to your LinkedIn connections. And I had about 300 or 400. And my only social media at the time was LinkedIn, 300 or 400 business connections. I happened to click that, uploaded, went home. And the next day was New Year's Eve. I had a date with my wife. It was fun. And that night after New Year's, I get a call from the producer of Good Morning America wanting me to be on their show from CES. And I was shocked. The next day, my partner who lives in Australia said, "What did you do?" I said, "Well, I made the video. I uploaded it." He says, "We have 300,000 views of that video in 36 hours. And I went, "What?" And I went to CES that Sunday. I was on Fox and Friends. I was on Good Morning America. I was on radio shows. My oldest son, who was an undergrad at Duke at the time, said, "Dad, I have friends who heard on the radio your video in Montana." And so this video went viral, hundreds of thousands of views. And I was contacted by just any number of venture capitalist companies like GE, reach back out to me. And I had been to GE. I had been to GE first, back to my old haunts of GE Healthcare. And they'd said, "Well, you know, we think this is kind of a toy, Dave. You know, people aren't really going to use this. It's not a hospital device. Medicare is not going to pay for it." They've since admitted I was correct. You know, it's the old adage, you don't skate to the puck, you skate to where the puck's going. And at the time in 2011 and 2010, digital health wasn't even a term anybody recognized. Okay. And so later in 2011, I was approached by a number of venture capitalists, people like Qualcomm Ventures, and ended up starting the company, putting it in San Francisco because I thought Silicon Valley was the right place to put it. Data Critical had been in Seattle, Washington, by the way, because at the time you had Microsoft. We started in Redmond. You had McCaw Communications, later became AT&T. It was a hotbed of technology. Amazon was just getting started. But now we started in San Francisco, later brought on Coastal Ventures, and began the odyssey that is today AliveCor, kind of a global brand selling product in 42 countries, so having sold millions of devices, and I can say very proudly, having saved a number of people's lives. So it's been a journey.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So for the people that are listening to really get it, what ended up being the business model of AliveCore? How do you guys make money?
Well, we make money two ways. We sell hardware. People see our ads on TV, or their physicians oftentimes recommend they buy our device. And then we have a whole suite of services, both for physicians and for patients, for customers. We have our cardiac care services that allow them to subscribe and get a whole series of enhancements to the basic functionality, which you've had from the beginning. You can record your ECG, you can email it to somebody, but we give you advanced analysis of that ECG. We give you connections directly to cardiologists to read your ECG. We give you monthly reports. And so we give you enhanced services, and we have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, cardiac care subscribers, and millions of customers. So we have a business. And now we have not only a consumer-oriented business, where you buy either from our website or Amazon, and that's true around the world, but we also have a commercial business that sells into healthcare, which is why we have a partnership with people like GE Healthcare, which focuses their business principally on the hospital. But we all know that patients are discharged from the hospital and go home. And healthcare will be increasingly focused outside of the hospital. And GE Healthcare saw AliveCore as one of the best avenues for them to be in that business of outside the hospital. They're very strong in, but they had almost nothing outside. And so, you know, we're glad to partner with them because inside the hospital is an important aspect of healthcare. You don't get your surgeries in your living room.
So according to PitchBook, you know, I see that you guys have raised 50 million plus. So I guess the question here that comes to mind is, what is the experience and the journey of, you know, financing, you know, a company like this? And obviously, you know, like now this is not your first rodeo, so you've done it multiple times. So why did you choose to bring on board the investors that you did, you know, end up choosing here?
Well, I wanted investors who had a view for the long term, because you know, if all you're focused on is a short term return, I don't want to be involved in that, because healthcare is a completely different beast. You know, this is not a social media play. This is not a TikTok. And so, you know, what you have to do to be accepted in healthcare, to get through the Food and Drug Administration, to be accepted by regulatory, to be accepted by the cardiologist, so that when their patient sends them an EKG, they believe it's accurate. To do that takes publications and peer-reviewed journals, takes time, takes running studies. It takes clinical validation. And so that takes time. That takes effort. That takes money. And I wanted investors who understood what it was going to take. And I think we have those kinds of investors.
So when it comes to bringing on board, you know, investors like this, you know, obviously vision is really big, right? Vision is a really big one. So if we're thinking about the vision here, and let's say I give you the opportunity of going to sleep tonight, and you wake up in a world where the vision of AliveCore is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Well, I just think we'll be in more hands. We'll be helping more patients. We'll be helping more doctors. And we'll be bringing acute cardiac connectivity to anywhere in the world. Be that South America, Africa, Asia, India, China, it doesn't matter where it is. But you know, today the smartphone is the front door to healthcare around the world. You can be anywhere and have a $30 Android phone that, quite frankly, is more powerful than your best phone of 25 years ago. And that device provides access. We want to add value to that device with our products and services and create opportunities to help patients and potentially save their lives.
So I guess for the people that are listening to get an idea on the scope and size of the operation today, how big is AliveCor? I mean, what can you share? What kind of impact have you guys, you know, brought already, you know, to life?
Well, we've sold millions of devices. We have hundreds of thousands of people who subscribe to our advanced services. We have scores of hospitals. If you looked at the U.S. News and World Report, leading cardiovascular hospitals, beginning with Cleveland Clinic, all those top 10 are AliveCor users and have literally thousands of patients using AliveCor devices. You have places like the Mayo Clinic, which is an investor in AliveCor and a corporate partner, and is today conducting more than a dozen studies using cardia devices. So we have unparalleled clinical acceptance at the best medical centers around the world, and that includes Canada, UK, Europe, Asia, as well as the confidence by consumers and patients that this is a quality device, despite the fact they can just buy it at their local drugstore or through Amazon.com.
And I'm wondering too, I mean, obviously when you started your first business in the late 80s compared to now, you know, there's been quite a bit of time that has passed, but also the venture world has changed too. I mean, I guess, how have you seen things changing and what are you experiencing now that, you know, it was not there before?
Well, I think, first of all, there are many more venture players now than there were then, okay? There's been an explosion in venture. And that, you know, you have many more players from family offices to private equity and many more limited funds. And I think that has created, you know, everybody's looking for a good deal, but how many more good deals are there? And then you have the fads, the trends, whether it was .com and today AI, generative AI. You have trends and fads. Some of them will stick. AI is definitely going to stick. But some of them come and go, like the .com boom, you know, pets.com, et cetera. And so I think we've seen the evolution just like the business cycle. It goes up and down. Venture isn't immune from that. We had SPACs. SPACs came, and I think they're now well gone as a financial fad, funding a lot of companies that probably, in hindsight, shouldn't have been public companies and should have stayed private, like AliveCor. And I think, you know, but Wall Street and finance is always looking for a new way to make money. Investment bankers create new vehicles with which they can make fees. That was another one.
So when it comes to the actual, you know, where things are heading, because you were touching on it, AI. I mean, everyone is talking about AI nowadays. Obviously, very interesting, the blend and the intersection between AI and medical devices that you guys are, you know, ultimately, you know, pushing here. Now, my question here is, where do you see the whole AI and medical device, you know, intersection? Where do you see that, you know, heading towards?
Well, there won't be any medical, computerized medical device that doesn't integrate AI into its operation. I mean, healthcare is in desperate need of improved efficiency. We don't have enough doctors. We don't have enough nurses. We just don't have enough access. And that's here in the United States where we spend way more than anyone else. The rest of the world has even fewer resources, yet a lot more people. So we've got to use AI to empower the current healthcare worker group to make them more efficient, to be able to deliver more care, to be able to reduce errors. And so I think it's inevitable that, you know, as people say, AI will not replace doctors, but doctors who utilize AI will replace those who do not. And I think that's the case. And when you talk about medicine, AI really means augmented intelligence. It's helping that doctor or that nurse not make a mistake, not overlook something critical to that patient's care. And I think so. The future is very bright for AI in healthcare. And it's not a short-term thing. It's a long-term thing and will continue to evolve.
So then in this case too, I mean, as we're thinking about, we'll be talking about the future, but I want to talk about the past and doing so with a lens of reflection. So let's say I was to bring you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, you know, maybe to that moment where you were coming out of college and you were thinking about before you were driving, obviously, your Corvette. But let's say, you know, before that, you know, before that moment where you decided to venture into the world of entrepreneurship, and that moment where you're thinking about taking that leap of faith and you're able to just show up and be right there in front of your younger self, and you're able to give that younger self one piece of advice, what would that be and why before launching a business, knowing what you know now?
I would have said go to business school, get an MBA, because I launched into business without knowing anything about business. And I have an MBA from the School of Hard Knocks. But I also learned that, you know, there's no I in team. And you need a team of people who can handle everything from HR to marketing to sales to regulatory to inventory, all the manufacturing, all these things that, quite frankly, I don't have any skill in, nor do I care about. And so it is the notion that it's dependent on a team. It's not dependent on me or a single person. And I think that's what I would tell myself 35 years ago.
So I guess the last thing that comes to mind, you know, as obviously you didn't go to business school, like you were saying, you wish you would have gone. And some of these, say, Hard Knocks lessons that you've learned, I think that there's probably been a ton of incredible self-development there to be able to grow at the same pace as the companies that you've built, especially now what you're doing with AliveCore. I guess when it comes to self-development and to you and to growing, you know, yourself, what is the biggest takeaway, you know, and something that maybe you can share with other founders that are listening when it comes to also making sure that they're not being outpaced by the company that they're building?
Well, I think it's the notion of surround yourself with the best people that have a passion, not only for your idea or your company, but for the things that they have to address. So you get the best HR people and the best marketing people and the best. And to be honest with you, from my perspective, I found a best CEO who can then go do those things. Because again, there are so many opportunities that require special skills that any one individual just simply isn't going to have. So you need to learn, delegate, and find the best people.
Amazing. So for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Well, I'm on X. I think we used to call it Twitter, at Dr. Dave 01, DRDAVE01. Same thing for LinkedIn, at Dr. Dave 01, DRDAVE01. So you can reach out to me, connect with me on either of those two social media platforms. And I'm happy. I have a lot of young entrepreneurs, physicians, inventors who come to me and ask advice and tell me they want to do what I did. And I said, no, you don't. You want to do what you're going to do, not what I did. But I'm happy to give you my stories of hard knocks and best paths.
Amazing. Well, Dr. Dave, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you, sir.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.